The Trump administration has been very clear about why they support Mohammed bin Salman. A number of times, Trump has said that the Saudis pay in cash. And so we've elected a businessman to the White House, and he's operating in a very businessman-like strategy where he is mostly concerned about how much money this is going to make the United States at the expense of not only, of course, international law and morality and humanitarian considerations, but also our own legal code and our own constitution. So nothing will get in the way of making money through the Saudis. And Mohammed bin Salman has been a very happy participant, with the Trump administration in power.
Shireen Al-Adeimi, I want to thank you for being with us. Yemeni scholar, activist, assistant professor at Michigan State University, speaking to us from Lansing. Democracy Now! Is now currently accepting applications for a development manager position, as well as our news production fellowship, both here in New York City. To get more information and to apply, go to democracynow.org. Very happy birthday to Neil Shabata and to Brendan Allen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. At the top of the hour, we hear part one of a special broadcast from the Pacific Radio Archives celebrating the 100-year anniversary of W.E.B. Du Bois' landmark publication, The Souls of Black Folk. Then at 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour, which burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time with social and political commentary from a social and socialist feminist point of view. Then at 10, it's Locus Focus. Host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Ann Zuckerman, Margaret Butler, and Mike Horner, the three climate activists who are set to stand trial for allegedly building a victory over climate change garden on the railroad yard and track at Zenith Energy Corporation. Then at 11, it's First Voices. Ross Hamilton speaks about his research of the lost and forgotten history of North America and the ancient legends. Ross's books include The Mystery of the Serpent Mound, A Tradition of Giants, and Star Mounds, Legacy of a Native American Mystery. Don't forget, you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. For a third way to listen to all of your favorite KBOO programming, then download our mobile app today.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The events committee meets the third Monday of every month at 5 o'clock p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Women's March, Sunday, March 1st, from noon to 3 p.m. at Portland State University South Park Blocks in Portland. Portland Women's March is a rally committed to advancing political and social change to create an inclusive safe space for women and their allies. Again, that's Portland Women's March, Sunday, March 1st, from noon to 3 p.m. at Portland State University South Park Blocks, 1436 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly series, where we get to profile some of the amazing recordings in our 55,000 program collection going back to 1949. I'm your host, Mark Torres. In 2003, the Pacifica Radio Archives celebrated the 100-year anniversary of W.E.B. Du Bois' landmark publication, The Souls of Black Folk, by producing a two-hour special narrated by actress Alfre Woodard. This program features Pacifica's 1953 interview with W.E.B. Du Bois and special guests who spoke about the impact of the souls of black folk in their lives, including then-Congresswoman Diane Watson of Los Angeles, historian, author, and professor Gerald Horn, and civil rights activist A.C. Byrd. We now present part one of Pacifica's 100 Years of the Souls of Black Folk.
Hi, I'm Alfre Woodard. This is a Pacifica Radio Archives special program commemorating the 100th anniversary of the publication of the seminal book, The Souls of Black Folk, by noted African-American intellectual and social leader William Edward Burghardt Du Bois. Featured in this program will be archival recordings of Dr. Du Bois in his own words. Our guests include Congresswoman Maxine Waters, Congresswoman Diane Watson, historians Playthell Benjamin, Gerald Horn, and civil rights activist A.C. Byrd.
He continued to support peace right up through until the time of his death.
What Du Bois did in his writings and his speeches was to identify the African elements of man and woman.
And so we see that The Souls of Black Folk in many ways was prophetic. In many ways, it's something akin to a Magna Carta when it comes to the elaboration of democratic rights in the United States of America.
His constant refrain is that all human beings, first of all, should have the necessities of life.
The 14 essays that comprise The Souls of Black Folk must be seen as the most influential of the literary texts that forged a racial consciousness.
We should measure the prosperity of a nation not by the number of millionaires, but by the absence of poverty, the prevalence of health, the efficiency of the public schools, and the number of people who can do read worthwhile books.
1868. Born William Edward Burghardt Du Bois on February 23rd to Mary and Alfred Du Bois in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. World Peace and Revolt in Africa with Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois. Broadcast February 20th, 1953.
We Negroes are not fighting tonight against slavery. That fight is won.
An interview conducted by Peter Hewen with Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois.
We hold the balance of political power in the North.
The discussion with Du Bois centers on minorities in the U.S.
Either we get the vote in the South or we come North and get it here.
Du Bois cites Booker T. Washington as having sought the American ideal, fighting for the right to own luxuries with no discrimination.
But we are fighting.
Du Bois asserts that we must realize our place as workers of the world.
And a chance to live as human beings.
Discussion followed about what is happiness, balance of body, mind, and spirit, and concepts of beauty, line, and color.
But we are fighting, and fighting desperately, the economic battle for the right to work and to get from our work food, housing, education, health, and a chance to live as human beings. But in this fight, we are not alone. With us stand and must stand, whether they will or no, the white workers of America and of the world. The continuation of a colonial world of slaves and serfs, cheek by jowl with a free world of workers with modern technique, is no longer possible. The effort to achieve this by yelling communism and by propelling this nation to pour death and destruction on helpless Korea and to seek in every way to re-enslave China must and will fail. You, as voters and intelligent citizens, must force peace on the professional soldiers and the business leaders who make fortunes in war. You must let the world know that this is your simple and unwavering program, the abolition of poverty, disease, and ignorance, the world over, among men and women of all races, religions, and colors. To accomplish this by just control of concentrated wealth and overthrow of monopoly. To ensure that income depends on work and not on privilege or chance. That freedom is the heritage of man, and that by freedom we do not mean freedom from the laws of nature, but freedom to think and believe and to express our thoughts and to dream our dreams and to maintain our rights against secret police, witch hunters, or any other sort of modern fool or tyrant. If work and ever increasing categories of work must be carried on for the common good, work like education, forest preservation and flood control, the suppression of epidemics, research into disease, the broad planning of cities, the allocation and integration of industry, if all this must be done for the good of all, it cannot be done by private initiative. It cannot be carried on for private profit. It must be planned. It must be conducted under discipline. And any set of social leaders who try to stop this social progress are enemies of mankind and destroyers of human culture. The four freedoms come not by slavery to corporations and monopoly of the press, cinema, radio, and television, but by united social effort for the common good, so that decently fed, healthy, and intelligent people can be sure of work, not afraid of old age, and hold high their heads to think and say what they damn please without fear of liars, informers, or a sneaking FBI. This is the life and the conception of life, which today is being denied us. Instead of regarding work as honorable and necessary, and its object as human service, we look on work as something to avoid, and its object as private profit. And so far as possible, profit for the man who does not do the work. Most Americans believe that without the incentive of private profit, industry would collapse. No. The object of work is what it does for human beings. And in all the long history of mankind, this has been the open and avowed end of human toil. It is only in the curious interval of modern history, marked by the discovery of America and the theft of capital, monopolized by force and used to enslave most of mankind to work for the few, that a theory of human life has arisen which reduces the people of Asia, Africa, and the islands of the sea to toil for the wealth of Europe and North America, and even in these lands makes most workers, although better paid than colored workers, yet too poor to be healthy and intelligent. When then modern world revolution started, of which that in Russia was but a part, revolution which has changed the face of industry in every modern nation, including our own. When that appeared here in America, there started a desperate effort to lead this nation into witch hunting and world war, to stop this world trend toward abolition of labor exploitation and toward a real brotherhood of man, and to abolish forever the vulgar rule of private wealth. Thus, the peace movement epitomizes in itself the world uplift today, and of this, American Negroes must become increasingly aware if they do not want to fall behind progress and hold back the march of men. This does not call for force or revolution. It does call for courage even to the loss of jobs, for daring to think and guts at least to listen, to the refusal to mistake money made by gamblers either at policy or in the stock market, or display of clothes or homes as progress. Progress is peace, and peace is time for food, homes for love, health for happiness, and books to read. Awake, awake, put on thy strength, O Zion, put on thy beautiful robe. There is in America today a confusion of mind so tragic and misleading that our whole thought and philosophy is distorted. At the very time that economics, that is, the study of work and income, is of foremost importance to our well-being, economics is not being studied in our schools. Neither in the elementary schools nor in colleges are students learning
about the philosophy of money and exchange, production and trade, wealth and saving. Our university students are pouring into chemistry and physics and deserting history and sociology. Why? Because to us, the basic problem is how large an income we can get, how much money we can control, what careers for our children will ensure them the most wealth. The object of our ambition is rising to higher and higher income brackets. And what we see as progress is escaping from manual labor to white-collar jobs, thence to employing others to work for us, then to coming into possession of so much property that we need not work for ourselves, so that we may sit in stark idleness or grovel in dissipation, having never learned anything to do except to arrange to have nothing to do. From this contradiction arises the strange paradox that the poverty for the worker must be perpetual in order that he be compelled to work for the rich. To most Americans, this paradox is at once true and impossible. They sit dumb and bemused before it. What is life but the attempt of human beings to be happy and contented in a world which, with all its ill, has a mass of sun and waters, of trees and flowers, of beauty and love? To realize this at its highest, we need food, clothes, and shelter. We need health of body and balance of mind. We want to know what this world is, how its wonderful laws act, who its peoples are, and how they think and act, and how what they have done in years and ages past may guide us today. We want to see, realize, and conceive beauty in form and line and color. We want to know our own souls and the myriad-sided souls of others, and then to imagine what might be if what is should grow to what we wish. This is life. This is the end and the fairy tale of life. We know this, and yet we sit dumb and muddled before it, seeing the world as a twisted contradiction. Yet the problem is simple. We have a rich land, earth and water, minerals and vegetables of every sort, breathtaking scenery in mountain, ocean, river, and vale. We have combed the earth of its races for strength, intelligence, and daring. All that is asked is that each of us do what we can, first to supply our own wants in food and shelter, health and learning. But more than that, that we do for others what they need done and cannot do for themselves, and yet which must be done lest we suffer.
Congresswoman Diane Watson.
I was very privileged to have an educated grandmother, and she talked to us about Mahatma Gandhi, Mary McLeod Bethune, W.E.B. Du Bois, and others. When we were little children, we had to sit at her feet. And what Du Bois brought to all of us is a kind of spiritual quality. He calls his book The Souls of Black Folk because he understood. As you know, he himself was a mixture. And my grandmother's mother was the result of the slave master and the slave. So she had a real sense of who she was and always wanted to go back to Africa. And she took my mother and her siblings, there were seven of them, down to hear Marcus Garvey. What Du Bois did in his writings and his speeches was to identify the African elements of man I'll use that generically, and woman, and what happened in the transition. And I talk about this often in my public speeches, and I try to compare the values of an African to the values of an African American. And what you have to do is to see that much of the behavior of African men and women here in America was learned behavior. What Du Bois did in his writing was to express the two-ness. You know, he's talked about the dual consciousness. And ingrained in us was a sense of who we were, because any true African can repeat his history for thousands of years. We don't know ours.
Civil rights activist A.C. Byrd.
I was in the United States Navy and in the North Pole, what they call an engineman. It was better explained that as a propulsion engineering tech on this icebreaker who was there to penetrate the ice. I later discovered that the real reason they were there is because not only to parade near the Bering Sea, and also that there were also nuclear weapons that was installed underground near the Soviet Union, as you know. And I looked in the ship library, and I was reading the various books they had in there, and one of the books I saw was W.E.B. Du Bois's work on Black Reconstruction, 1860 to 1880, in which he expressly addressed the issues of the blacks who fought in the war, the 200,000 troops, who fought in the Civil War to assist the Union in defeating its slavocracy of that period, and also an interpretation of Reconstruction, that the Reconstruction period when we were betrayed by the 1877 deal that was struck between Hayes and Tilden. In the President Hayes, who became President, and Tilden, reached a compromise where the troops was pulled out of the South, therefore leaving African Americans vulnerable to the original slave owners who had now gotten back into power. So it was a really fascinating work. I was at first understood this to be a history, but it did caused me to question why I was even in the military and what was the role that we were playing at that time in the military. And I think this was, it began to make me think critically about where I was, you know, what kind of relationships that I have, what kind of relationships that black folks had with respect to the military and others. And I didn't quite understand it in its full dimension, because in Black Reconstruction, this book, there was a great deal of attention paid to the troops, the 200,000 and 200, now we know 209,000 African American uniformed persons who actually participated on the side of the Union to help defeat the Confederacy. And I wasn't quite certain what he was talking about until I, you know, read him further and read more books about him, until, you know, I began to equate myself with those troops without understanding the other dimensions that Du Bois was trying to lay out, because he had a worldview and he was taking on the role of U.S. foreign policy and what it was doing in the world, setting up a hegemonic system of imperialism. I had to later discover that. And this book, of course, as you know, was written very early, and it was published in 1935. So I didn't read it before near the 1960s.
Congresswoman Maxine Waters.
I was first introduced to W.E.B. Du Bois back when I was in my early 20s, a young mother raising two kids. And I'd never had any opportunity to know about him when I was in school. We didn't have much in the way of black history in those days. Nope.
When I was first taking history classes in elementary school, because then I could not help but notice the omission of figures of African descent for the most part, and that sent me to the library. I think I was probably at the age of 8 years old and began to read about Black American history and African history, and I think it was in that context that I personally discovered the W.E.B. Du Bois. But as you may know, my first book was about the last years of his life, and that was based upon my doctoral dissertation. And then I wrote another book, Race Woman, The Lives of Shirley Graham Du Bois, which was about his wife, Shirley Graham Du Bois. But, of course, he plays a leading role in that particular drama. So it's fair to say that W.E.B. Du Bois has been with me almost all of my life, certainly all of my adult life.
These are days of
W.E.B. Du Bois, from a recording produced by Gene D'Alessi in 1968 at KPFA in Berkeley, California, as a part of a series entitled Black Man in America, 1619 to the Present. This recording includes actuality of Du Bois on the racial attitudes of Presidents Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, along with comments from his family and friends.
For those who have seen a world marching toward the welfare state and then hesitating and partially retreating before the counter-revolution. In human history, there's nothing unusual in this situation. Progress is seldom continuous. Time and time again in the history of mankind, it has faltered, and we have only to remember that the progress of men, which is not to be doubted in the long, long run, is never a straight march, but is always a lurching forward and a falling back. And we only keep up hope as we see that progress has continued and will continue. Nevertheless, in these days of uncertainty, we have to live, and here in the United States, where for many it is difficult to earn a living without selling one's soul to falsehood and greed, where it is not always safe to speak or write frankly unless one agrees with current public opinion. This is the time of all times when the wise man falls back on clear thinking, which is still possible, and on real knowledge, which is still attainable, in order at least in his own soul to know the truth and to build a future on it. Let me venture to recall some pertinent things which have happened in the 56th year of the last five centuries. In the year 1456, the Turks had just captured Constantinople, and Mohammedanism and Christianity stared each other face to face. Gutenberg had published a Bible with movable type. Prince Henry the Navigator had opened an unknown world, while a little ragged boy of five, Christopher Columbus, was racing through the streets of Genoa and watching its great ships sail away. In China, the Ming Dynasty reigned, and scholars were publishing dictionaries. The people, the great mass of all people, were dumb, driven cattle. But among the leading few of Europe, a curiosity to know the past arose, a yearning stirred in their breasts for the fair face of beauty all too fair to see. Michelangelo painted and carved in the Vatican, cathedrals blossomed in stone. This was the age of Renaissance. But what were the people doing and thinking? The ordinary people who work and slave to feed and clothe the world. We know very little of them. They toiled under rod and whip. They died like flies when the Black Death swept from Constantinople to London, where alone 68,000 died. They walked in dirt and rags and lice. 400 years ago, in 1556, three men were destined to remake our conception of the world as the center of the universe. Copernicus was dying. Galileo was being born, and Francis Bacon, father of modern science, was 5 years old. Suleiman the Magnificent had his foot on the heart of Europe, and the great Emperor Akbar reigned in India. In Europe, the masses of awakening men tried to believe in good. they fought and killed to believe. Luther died in 1546, and in the mad throes of Reformation which followed, millions were crippled, burned, and killed. In one wild night in 1572, 50,000 Christians murdered each other and reddened the streets of France. The punishment of crime was based on revenge, exquisite pain, and protection of property. Criminals were to be killed, not cured. In the throes of religion, from the beginning of the 15th century to the end of the 18th, 300,000 witches were tortured, hanged, and burned alive. One was Joan of Arc. The Mongols swept over the toiling masses of India. 300 years ago, in 1656, Shakespeare had sung his song and played his part and was 40 years dead at 50 years of age. The 30 Years' War, perhaps the most horrible of modern times, was 8 years yet ended, but its misery and filth still live. John Bunyan was in jail writing Pilgrim's Progress. Milton was recording the loss of paradise, and Moliere was amusing the court of Louis XIV. In India, the Taj Mahal was standing in sheer beauty, and the Chinese had issued an encyclopedia in 24,000 volumes. The year 1756 was in the center of the age of science. Johnson's dictionary was published. But symbolically cutting across this year saw the Black Hole of Calcutta, an Asiatic protest against European intrusion, and Lisbon had an earthquake which killed tens of thousands. In Africa, the Black Mandingo empires were spreading Mohammedanism west and south, and the heathen Bantu peoples began marching south, where a century later they met the Boers. In between the slowly retreating millions and the state-building intruders, Western Christianity thrust with trade in gold, pepper, and slaves. On the slavery of Negroes, Britain founded her wealth, her commerce, and her empire. Capitalistic production was built on her slave trade. As Karl Marx wrote in a celebrated passage, "If money comes into the world with a congenital bloodstain on one cheek, capital comes dripping from head to foot with every pore filled with blood and dirt." England seized India at Plassey. George III reigned and later lost America. Robert Owen and William Godwin argued the matter of income for the poor. William Pitt and Benjamin Franklin guided politics and science. And exactly 200 years ago this year, the Seven Years' War began colonial imperialism of the white European world over the darker nations of the earth, an adventure which still fights at Suez this very day. Exploitation of labor, that is, the inborn idea that most men are born to work for the support, ease, and luxury of the few, for various reasons like superior merit, color of skin, or progress of culture. This idea, beginning in slavery and developing through serfdom to wage labor and military might, still exists today in the minds of most folk to poison every effort to raise the mass of men into real and effective equality. 100 years ago today, Darwin was working on his Origin of Species. The Negroid Dumas was writing his novels, and Rousseau was finishing his Social Contract. But the Bessemer process of making steel was transforming industry into dictatorship, and the Communist Manifesto, then 8 years old, was beginning to ferment in the minds of discontented men. The labor movement, with strikes and unions, began to spread in Europe. The Cotton Kingdom arose in America. Russian serfs were emancipated in 1861, but in the United States, the Supreme Court heard the arguments in the Dred Scott case and its decision in 1857 tried to fasten slavery on American Negroes forever, while John Brown raided the slave owners in Kansas. The Crimean War was fought to subject the Balkans, including Hungary, to West Europe, and the War of England against China aimed at complete European domination of the entire East. The West fought bitterly against popular education, for the continued subjection of women, and against votes for the mass of laborers. The reform bills and our civil war heralded change. With this background, there was left a weird task for the 20th century. We could scarcely be surprised if we have not, in 1956, even begun to clean up the mess. Neither surprised nor discouraged, we see a head-on collision between social progress and incorporated wealth, striving to save scientific knowledge from the monopoly of private wealth and build a state which would exist for the benefit of those who have made it and need it, and not for those who by chance or legal chicanery claim to own it. On the whole, the progress towards such states has succeeded in a marked degree in most nations. In Russia, Eastern Europe, and China, its success has been the wonder of our age, which nothing can disparage, even if we know that the path has not been straight, nor the goal wholly attained. In the United States, we have far from failed. We have moved decisively toward the welfare state by mass education and a standard of living above that of most of the world. State roads, housing, and federal flood control, recognition of labor unions, scientific research and marvelous technique helped by the government, and a growing recognition of the right even of black folk to live as equals of whites. All this has lulled the nation to acquiescence in our great losses, the failure of democratic control of our government, the increasing rule of private wealth, and the use of that wealth for war on socialism, for control of colonial labor and materials. To support this dictatorship of the rich, we have tried to stop our bold and wise men from thinking and expressing their thought, and from pointing out our mistakes and danger. The counter-revolution of private wealth against social welfare has put many of our leaders in jail, and has scared most of our scientists into silence, has choked literature, hamstrung news gathering, and made our teachers of youth the mouthpieces of private industry, set on making millions of the peoples of the earth the serfs of the white West. For this end, even our organized white labor has been bribed and misled, and civilization has become spending income for show, indulgence, and world war, rather than for further conquest of poverty, disease, and ignorance. This is the battle we must yet win, because looking on the past, we know that American big business is fighting the very stars in their courses.
You are listening to a Pacifica Radio Archives special program commemorating the 100th anniversary of the publication of Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois's seminal book, The Souls of Black Folk. I'm Alfre Woodard. We'll be back after this break.
You are listening to part one of 100 Years of the Souls of Black Folk on From the Vault. If you would like to get a copy of this program or the entire two-part series, go to fromthevaultradio.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. And now back to part one of Pacifica's 100 Years of the Souls of Black Folk.
Almost alone among the prominent social scientists, the anthropologist Franz Boas maintained that innate racial differences were inconsequential. Black Americans were being lynched at the rate of almost 100 every year. Race riots of major importance took place throughout the country. from the Wilmington, North Carolina riot of 1898 and the New York riot of 1900, to their bloody climax in Springfield, Illinois in 1908 and Atlanta, Georgia in 1906.
Difficult were the heartbreaking setbacks, the arrogance of the dominant classes, the sheer cruelty of monopoly, the unconcern while a whole people was crucified.
This is Dr. Herbert Apthecker, a custodian of Dr. Du Bois' papers and an intimate colleague of Du Bois.
At times the pain was so great that it squeezed out from his great heart, as after the 1906 Atlanta slaughter, in his great poem, The Litany at Atlanta, he wrote, "Whither? North is greed and south is blood, within the coward and without the liar. Whither, O God, whither to death?"
38 years
civil rights activist A.C. Byrd.
Du Bois in 1903 published this document, and I think that what it did, it gave us an insight in ourselves, and it gave us a critical analysis of how we looked at the United States and how we looked at ourselves, and also made the famous prediction of the 20th century being regarded by a century of racism. And I think that this really brought it home to many of us. And he also, during that period, he called for a 100-year study of the life and culture of black Americans in order to answer the question of what he perceived as the great myth in society that portrayed African Americans as inferior.
Every time I feel the spirit moving in my heart, I will pray.
Historian Playfell Benjamin.
I first heard of the souls of black folk when my great aunt Rosa, a high school literature teacher, presented me with a copy of Dr. Du Bois' essay Of the Sorrow Songs to read as an introduction to a concert that my great aunt Marie, a classically trained pianist and choir master, was conducting with the school choir. Since the program consisted exclusively of the sacred music of the African-American slave community, Dr. Du Bois' essay was the perfect text to serve as prologue. The combined power of the music and text swept over me like a mighty cloud of joy and pathos that set my spirit a-dancing. Afterward, I was intrigued by this strange little book that held within its covers tall tales spun from the lives and struggles of my ancestors. I was determined to read it from cover to cover. And when I had read the last word of the doctor's eloquent and powerful prose, I was changed. Reconsidering the Souls of Black Folk, the text from which I will be reading, was the brainchild of the editors and marketing people at Running Press of Philadelphia. They thought it a good idea to publish a book-length review of Dr. Du Bois' classic text on the centennial of its publication in 1903, and hired myself and Stanley Crouch, a MacArthur Genius Award winner, to write it. After perusing the list of commentators on Dr. Du Bois' work for this special, I decided that his political views would be well covered. So my reading will concentrate on W.E.B. Du Bois as literary artist and commentator on Afro-American culture.
Sweet Lord, sweet chariot, coming.
The title of my essay is The Souls of Black Folk, Poetry, Prophecy, Pioneering Social Science. In his 1903 book, The Souls of Black Folk, W.E.B. Du Bois, then an obscure young black scholar with contempt for conventional wisdom on issues of race and class, produced a text combining poetic mysticism, scholarly rigor, and passionate advocacy, rendered in a powerful style reminiscent of Shakespeare and the King James Bible. The book set the standard for engaged intellectuals in 20th century America. Its influence extended beyond America's shores, as verified by the remembrances of South African novelist Peter Abrams, the Trinidadian polymath C.L.R. James, and the Afro-British classical composer Samuel Coleridge Taylor. Francophone intellectuals such as the Haitian scholar Jean-Price Mar, the poet Léon Damar of Caen, and the poet-statesman Léopold Sédar Senghor, who along with Damar is the founder of the Negritude literary movement in the French language and became the first president of the West African Nation of Senegal, also testified to having been moved by the book. Hence, the 14 essays that comprise the souls of black folk must be seen as the most influential of the literary texts that forged the racial consciousness of what the Afro-British sociologist Paul Gilroy has called the Black Atlantic World. Yet it was in the U.S. that the souls had its greatest impact. It allowed white Americans a glimpse of the inner life and hopes of their black countrymen, and black Americans found an advocate with the courage, eloquence, and intellect to voice their spiritual strivings without the cautious apologia of Booker T. Washington, the most famous and powerful black man in America, who got his comeuppance in the essay of Mr. Booker T. Washington and others. The ideas in that essay, particularly the ideas of the talented 10th, are still debated as I write, and yet a century has passed. And Gilroy argues its power is still felt in the special resonance with the term soul continues to enjoy in modern black political discourse and cultural axiology.
Sweet Lord, sweet chariot, come in.
In his voluminous writings, we are afforded a glimpse of the soul of Du Bois, a man of the people whose love and admiration for the gifts of the common folk is revealed again and again. But nowhere more poignantly than in his essay of the Sorrow Songs, his panegyric to the body of sacred music forged by Afro-American slaves that became world famous as the Negro Spirituals. It is more than a little instructive that so many of these latter-day bourgeois savants who prattle on ad nauseum about Du Bois's elitism have neglected this jewel which peers into the souls of the black folk and reveals their beauty to the world. It also celebrates the saga of the artists, all budding members of the talented 10th, who concretize their message of boundless faith and miraculous fortitude to the world. In an essay redolent with wisdom and beauty, Du Bois explained the relationship of the spirituals to the inspiration and design of his book. David walked in darkness, sang songs in the older days, he says, sorrow songs, for they were weary at heart. And so before each thought that I have written in this book, I have said a phrase, a haunting echo of these weird old songs in which the soul of the black slave spoke to men. This declaration tells us from the outset that Du Bois conceived of these songs as the musical text of an epic drama played out on American soil for 2.5 centuries, and that this drama, a titanic struggle between righteousness and evil, master and slave, was a force in shaping the character and sensibility of the new American nation called the United States. Furthermore, for Du Bois, the best and most humane expression of the sensibility arising from that great moral struggle came from the black slaves and is embodied in the Sorrow Songs. Little beauty has America given the world save the rude grandeur God himself stamped on her bosom, he writes. The human spirit in this new world has expressed itself in vigor and ingenuity rather than in beauty. And so by fateful chance, the Negro folk song, the rhythmic cry of the slaves, stands today not simply as the sole American music, but as the most beautiful expression of human experience born this side of seas. The singular spiritual heritage of the nation and the greatest gift of the Negro people. Although Du Bois apologizes for his lack of musical knowledge in the explication of these songs, I find his grasp of music superior to the majority of literary lions and social scientists, Albert Murray, Stanley Crouch, and George Bernard Shaw being notable exceptions. But when one is capable of capturing the spirit of an art form as Du Bois does in the following passage, specialized knowledge is irrelevant.
No more auction block for me. No more auction block for me.
What are these songs, and what do they mean? He asked. I know little of music and can say nothing in technical phrase, but I know something of men, and knowing them,
I know that these songs are the articulate message of the slave to the world. They tell us in these eager days that life was joyous to the black slave, careless and happy. But not all the past South, though it rose from the dead, can gainsay the heart-touching witness of these songs. They are the music of an unhappy people, of the children of disappointment. They tell of death and suffering and unvoiced longing toward a truer world, of misty wanderings and hidden ways. It is clear that Du Bois's discussion of this music is not some cold intellectual exercise, but a revelation of the heart. Indeed, this passion, which can only come from an engaged intellectual, informs all of his work. The power of Du Bois's prose is a product of his involvement in the fight to vindicate the humanity of black people against the barrage of racist propaganda and uplift the race. The reader can feel the love in Du Bois's remembrances of how he felt when he arrived at Fisk, the home of the world-famous Jubilee Singers, and his description of how the nation first came to hear the sorrow songs. After recounting how the spirituals had bewitched him as a boy, he goes on to tell us, "Then in years when I came to Nashville, I saw the great temple, builded on these songs, towering over the pale city. To me, Jubilee Hall seemed ever made of the songs themselves, and its bricks were red with blood and dust of toil. Out of them rose for me morning, noon, and night, burst of wonderful melody, full of the voices of the past. Away back in the 30s, the melody of these slave songs stirred the nation, but the songs were soon half forgotten. Then in wartime came the singular Port Royal experiment, after the capture of Hilton Head, and perhaps for the first time, the North met the Southern slave, face to face and heart to heart, with no third witness."
Deep river, my home is over Jordan. Deep river, Lord.
Then, in a passage of uncommon erudition and eloquence, Du Bois tells us of the meeting of soldier, slave, and tutor amid the destruction and dislocation in the aftermath of Civil War. The Sea Islands of the Carolinas, he writes, where they met, were filled with a black folk of primitive type, touched and molded less by the world about them than any others outside the black belt. Their appearance was uncouth, their language funny, but their hearts were human and their singing stirred men with a mighty power. Thomas Wentworth Higginson hastened to tell of these songs, and Miss McKim and others urged upon the world their rare beauty. But the world listened only half credulously until the Fisk Jubilee Singers sang the slave songs so deeply in the world's heart that it could never wholly forget them again. Here Du Bois is alluding to the poignant descriptions of Afro-American singing in Thomas Wentworth Higginson's classic text, Army Life in a Black Regiment. An abolitionist who commanded Afro-American troops in the Civil War, Higginson heard black singing in a way that was rare for Northern whites, and Lucy McKim, who was a trained musician, had tried to notate the songs using the Aeolian harp, but was bewildered by the unusual tones, as later conventionally trained musicians would be when trying to notate the solos of Thelonious Monk.
To cross over into Camp Grove.
The great virtue of all these essays in this collection is the delicate balance between the voices of the poet, prophet, historian, and social scientist in the narrative. But, depending upon the question to be explicated, some voices are naturally more prominent than others. Hence, although the sociologists and economists take the lead in some essays, the poet and the prophet are ever present. While Stanley Crouch and I hold radically different views of the political legacy of Dr. Du Bois, we have no disagreement about his role as literary innovator, who influenced a wide variety of Afro-American literary artists.
Mm-hmm.
And his expression of discontent as opposed to the mask of humility Washington wore to protect himself and his enterprise, writes Crouch. Du Bois reveals a post-Reconstruction sensibility as at home, moving from the lowlands to the places where the high-minded congregate and cogitate. This is the Du Bois who resonates through the world of Jean Toomer, and whose engagement with folk materials surely anticipates, though in different ways, the work of the poet Langston Hughes and the novelist Zora Neale Hurston, especially her interpretation of Negro American art styles. Even a writer at such great odds with Du Bois as Albert Murray, whose narcissistic sense of his own importance is no less large, can be seen rewriting the souls of black folk and his own South to a Very Old Place, where we get a very different sense of Negro American identity and an unprecedented portrait of Southern black college life as Murray, in quite brilliant and virtuosic prose, recalls his Depression-era days at Tuskegee, Booker T. Washington's creation, and command post. Murray describes a favorite teacher's high-minded vision of the inner life and writes, quote, "Mortiza Drexel Sprague expected you to proceed in terms of the high standards of formal scholarship. Among other things, not because he wanted you to become a carbon copy of any white man who ever lived, not excepting Shakespeare and even Leonardo da Vinci, but because to him, you were the very special vehicle through which contemporary man, and not just contemporary black man even, could inherit the experience and insights of all recorded or decipherable time." And on the wings of Atalanta, Du Bois had already aimed for the distant star when he wrote, "The function of the university is not simply to teach breadwinning or to furnish teachers for the public schools or to be center of polite society. It is, above all, to be the organ of that fine adjustment between real life and the growing knowledge of life, an adjustment which forms the secret of civilization." Du Bois was, within that volume, already arguing for the contemplative life and raising his voice in opposition to the utilitarian sense of education represented by Booker T. Washington, of whom Du Bois wrote early in the chapter of Mr. Booker T. Washington and Others. So thoroughly did he learn the speech and thought of triumphant commercialism and the ideals of material prosperity that the picture of a lone black boy poring over French grammar amid the weeds and dirt of a neglected home seemed to him the acme of absurdities. One wonders what Socrates and St. Francis of Assisi would say to this. By referring to the Greek philosopher willing to die for his beliefs and the saint of the Catholic Church, Du Bois made it clear that he considered himself to be one who could inherit the experience and insights of all recorded or decipherable time. This is even true of Ralph Ellison, of whose work the exceptional scholar Robert O'Mealy has written in The Craft of Ralph Ellison. In Ellison's fiction, folklore, stylized and transformed by modernist techniques, gives special resonance and power to his language as it frees his characters to fly toward the moon, dive unmarked into the briar patch, or become invisible and sail through the air unseen. Here the vernacular and the symbolist tradition in American literature converge. And who, if not Du Bois, foreshadowed with his speaking from behind the veil, Ellison's metaphor of invisibility? Who, if not Du Bois, provided the point of departure for the conclusion arrived at by Ellison's narrator, which is that, as the older writer says in The Souls of Black Folk, he begun to have a dim feeling that, to attain his place in the world, he must be himself and not another. This is the same thing that Richard Wright concludes in The Full American Hunger, itself a source for Invisible Man. Who, if not Du Bois, by writing elsewhere in that epic contemplation of black souls? Through history, the powers of single black men flash here and there like falling stars and die sometimes before the world has rightly gazed their brightness, provided Ellison with a source for his metaphor when the novelist's narrator sees some zoot suit wearing Negroes on a subway train and wonders if they're culturally parallel to lights from stars long dead.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society's concert series featuring Sam Ryder and the Human Hands, an ensemble from the worlds of jazz and folk music. The show is Friday, February 21st, 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. Sam Ryder has been a U.S. State Department musical ambassador, taking his accordion to at least 6 years.
Oh, I wish that the most.
For 6 years, Ryder has been band leader for jazz at the Lincoln Center's youth program. The Human Hands feature the violin stylings of Oregonian Alex Hargraves. For more information about the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Johnnie sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Johnnie sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. We are sorry that we had to cut off the last program. It was put on the air a couple minutes too late, and it was going to throw the rest of the morning off. The Old Mole is a political magazine for the radio. We bring you interviews, reviews, commentary, analysis, music, history from a radical socialist feminist point of view. To start off today's show, we're going to do something a little different. Bill Resnick's going to introduce a few installments of documentary narrator sharing.